I also get to make good on something that I said I would do
about a year ago, which was
give a sermon on the two conversations that take place between God and Satan in Job chapters 1 and 2. When we had a class on this, we were moving pretty fast, and it was just not the right time to bring up a deep dive on one of these topics. Now, basically, this is like a familiar passage to most of us that we've read this over and over. We've read what God said to Satan in Job 1 and 2, and we have a certain level of familiarity with this passage and with a lot of others. And so when I started going through these to try to figure out what was really going on, I realized just how much I didn't know about these conversations and how much I had been missing. We'll start in Job chapter 1 today. And I was just fascinated that I could have read over these so many times and really failed to grasp the impact of what was going on here. And so hopefully we can take a deeper dive, have a better understanding of these conversations, and there's an application for us here as well. So this is called Two Conversations. Now in our scripture reading, we read the first conversation of these two conversations. But first I want to start with Job 1:1. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." Okay? So, that is Job. That's the person we're focusing on, the character that we're focusing on as far as what kind of a person he is. Now, one thing I want to clarify is in our reading in verse 6, when we had... In verse 6 it reads, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." I want to clarify what sons of God is talking about so we don't get off on the wrong foot. If we go to Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2, Genesis 6 verse 2, it says, "The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose." And then down in verse 4 in that same chapter, it says, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown." Okay. Furthermore, in Galatians, Paul explains what it means to be a son of God. In Galatians 3, verse 26. Galatians 3:26 says, "For in Christ Jesus you are all sons of God through faith." The point here is that we're not talking about angels, and this is not a scene that's playing out in heaven. We're talking about men, we're talking about human beings. Additionally, and it's not up on the board, but if you look at Hebrews, let's turn there, Hebrews 1:5, also really kind of serves to nail this one down in place. Hebrews 1:5 says, "For to which of the angels did God ever say, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you,' or again, 'I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son'?" So I just want to make it clear, we're not talking about angels in this scene that's playing out here in Job 1. Okay? Now you ask yourself, well, how is it that Satan could come among them? Well, think of it this way. The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. The sons of God is referring to people. People can't just walk into the presence of God, can they? Maybe not physically, like how we would do it someday when we finally stand before Him. But right here, right now, we're presenting ourselves before God. That's what we do in prayer. That's what we do when we assemble to worship God, gather in His presence. Even though we're not seeing Him with our own eyes, we're still gathering together to worship Him. Similar situation here. And Satan also came among them. Of course, your temptations don't stop when you walk through those doors. And worldly thoughts don't go away magically. So would it be so implausible to say that Satan could be among us as well? Maybe tempting us to be distracted or whatever. Very plausible, I think. Now, So we're talking about people here, and the conversation begins in verse 7. I always found it interesting that God asks Satan a question that he already knew the answer to. If you've ever wondered why he did that, the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Now that's interesting enough for me to look at closer. This is like a question that God already knew the answer to, but he asked it anyway. He knew Satan's whereabouts. He knew what he'd been up to. But even so, he still asked. You ever asked a question where you knew the answer? Like, you know, maybe I'll think of parenting, you know, what happened at school today? Or what happened at your friend's house? Those are generic enough questions, but when they refer to something specific that's implicit that you haven't mentioned, what happened at school today? That's a generic question, but the meaning behind it is well known, if I'm asking. And so the response is more important, necessarily, than the truth that's already known that that answer would serve to illustrate. Now, Psalm 139, we go there a little bit. I won't read verses 1 through 10. I'll just read a couple verses here. Verses 2 and 3. It says, "You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways." You see, God knows what's happening in his creation. He's already aware. Okay? Now, Satan provides an answer to God. Notice, he couldn't opt out of it. He had to answer. Now, a lot of people that don't have as good of a knowledge as a lot of us in this room of spiritual matters and of the Bible would assume that God and Satan are spiritual equals, but at opposite ends of the spectrum. This is not the case. And even if we didn't know that before this conversation or these two conversations, we would know that by the end of them because it's very clear who's in charge here, and it's not Satan. So I just want to point out, as we know, they're not just equals at the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, you got God on one side and you got Satan on the other, and that's just how it is. So even though Satan's God's archenemy, they're not equals. Okay. Now, Satan provides an answer, and he actually answers more. He gives more information than he was even asked for. Because God asked, "From where have you come?" That's a location issue. But what does Satan say? Verse 7, he says, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." Now, this is interesting here, okay? Because Satan is not just being smart-alecky or redundant in his answer. It seems like he repeats himself, but he actually doesn't. Now, if we look here, you think about this, to and fro, okay? And the ESV is very, very illustrative of this particular point. When you're talking about to and fro, this is a back and a forth movement, okay? That's specific on what it's describing. Up and down. We know that, right? That's obvious enough. So when Satan says, "I've been going to and fro, and up and down," what is he saying? He's been going everywhere. Everywhere on the earth. Additionally, he says, "I've been going to and fro, and I've been walking up and down." Why the difference? Well, let's think about this. Now, our good friends, the Feasters, who were here for about a year, are now at the Matthew Street Church of Christ in Texas, in Bay City, Texas. So I consulted Google Maps. How long would it take me if I were to drive down to the church that they're at from here? How long is that going to take me if I go down there? Well, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 hours, okay? And that's variable. I might get distracted by some steakhouse in Texas on the way. Nonetheless, about a 15-hour drive, okay? That's going. We go down there, it takes us about 15 hours by car, a way that we're familiar with. However, if I'm really crazy and I decide I'm going to walk down to Bay City, Texas, Google tells me that this will take somewhere in the neighborhood of 306 hours. That's 12 and three-quarter days. Do you think there's some things that I would see walking down to Texas that I would completely miss on a drive at 75 miles an hour down there? Of course. I would see a lot more, as a matter of fact, and in greater detail. You see, so what Satan's saying here is, I am taking time to walk through your earth and go everywhere. I'm deliberate about what I'm doing. And he wants God to know that. He's deliberate about his activities. This is not random. A spiritual being who is not confined to our modes of travel, who could be in China one instant and right in this room in another. He's not confined to walking speed, but he chooses to answer God in such a way to describe the level of deliberation that he has in his efforts on the earth. So he's not redundant at all. Now, in response to this answer from Satan, God asked Satan a very interesting question. In verse 8, he says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Have you heard of Job? Now, obviously, with Satan going to and fro and walking up and down on the earth, he's seen Job. Additionally, we have apostles with the same name, so I highly doubt that there was only one Job on the earth at that time. I'm just kind of guessing, but I would imagine that there was more than one Job. Okay? Just keep that in mind for Satan's answer. But it's not so much a question of, have you in your travels heard of this guy, Job? But the nature of this question is more like, okay, so you have been going everywhere in the world. Well, then what do you make of a man who remains upright despite the fact that you are on the loose, prowling around this earth, doing what you do, being deliberate? What do you make of this guy who's able to remain upright? It's a pretty good question. That's an anomaly. That would definitely stand out. You see, Job was blameless and upright. This is how God describes him. This is how God praises a created being in his creation. Now, blameless, he's not doing anything wrong. It's not that he's never sinned, but he's not doing anything wrong. I mean, mostly he's a great guy and upright. So he is doing what's right. It's not just an absence of evil, but it's the choice to do what's right. And additionally, he turns from evil. God says that he turns from evil. So what does this tell you? It's not that there's an absence of evil in Job's life. Not at all. But rather, Job makes the choice, the deliberate choice, to turn from it. That's also important for Satan's reply to God here in a second. Okay? All right. Now, of course, Satan has something to say about this. And he responds in verse 9. And he says, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land." Okay. So first off, Satan immediately knows who God is talking about. It's not, well, which Job? There's more than one on the earth, probably. No, he knows who he's talking about instantly. And even though God just praised Job, Satan insists that there are reasons other than an upright character why Job would praise God, why he would be upright, why he would turn from evil. Well, it's not the great thing you think it is, God. It's actually something completely different. Okay? Now, Satan insists that God has given Job an unnatural advantage. You know, you have blessed the work of his hands. It's you that's done this. It's not him. And he's also said, you've protected him from evil. And remember what God just said in the previous verse. He turns from evil. Job doesn't have an absence of evil. He just simply turns from it. He doesn't have an absence of evil in his life seeking to bring him down. He turns from it. But Satan insists, whatever. You protected him, so you haven't let anything bad happen to him. This is why. You sheltered him, and you blessed everything he did. So of course he's going to love you. So Satan insists that there's a reason other than because God is great and Job wants to be upright that he would fear God. Ultimately, what it boils down to, according to Satan, is material wealth. Look at what he has, God. You've blessed him so much. Of course he's going to love you. Let's go back to Job 1:1. What does it tell us? The very first thing it tells us in this book is there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright. One who feared God and turned away from evil. Then it proceeds to describe his wealth and his other situation, his situation more thoroughly. The very first thing it tells us is his character, not what he was blessed with. Okay? So his character is listed first. Now I want to contrast his character to that of his family. We know in his speeches with his friends that his family just rejected him. They were nowhere to be found in this. Now, if we go to Job 42, toward the end of this story, Job 42, verse 10, starting in verse 10, it says, "And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and ate bread with him in his house, and they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him, and each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold." Well, now his family's back. Now when he's back on top, now they provide sympathy. I want to contrast that with Job's character because he stayed with God in the midst of turmoil and tragedy. All right. Now, Satan continues. As we said, you've protected him, you've blessed him, and so it's just greedy self-interest, whatever. It doesn't matter. Job 1:11. Now, this is Satan's demand because Satan's theory doesn't come with a demand or a hypothesis to test it out. Satan says, "But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." Okay. So first off, Satan admits that it's within God's power to do this thing that he's asking for. God has the authority to do this here. And a created being, a human being, Job, who's never seen God before, face to face, Satan's convinced that not only is he going to turn from God, but he's going to curse him to his very face should this happen. Okay? You take everything away, and Job's integrity goes with it, simple as that, according to Satan. Now, have you ever asked yourself, well, in verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, you got to wonder, why God allowed this? All right. Now, we know what the end of the story is, and so we might be quick to say, well, it's because of God's glory, right? In the end, God will be glorified by everything that happened to Job and by the resulting actions that Job took. God's going to be glorified. Okay, fair enough. I would say that's partially correct. Still, though, why does God give Satan the power to do this? Because remember what Satan asked. Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. God doesn't actually do that. He gives that authority over to Satan instead of doing it himself. So beyond what God is going to have in the way of glory at the end of all this, I think another big reason that God probably did this in the way that he did it, if God gave Satan the authority to do this, and Satan carried this out to his absolute fullest of his abilities, there could be no claim from Satan back to God that said, somehow God took it easy on Job. You know, imagine if God said, okay, great, there, I've stretched out my hand, and it's just exactly as you want it. And then Job remained upright. Okay? Imagine if all the things that happened to Job in chapter 1 happened, but because God stretched out his hand, and then God said to Satan, see, there you go. Satan could still make the claim that God took it easy on Job. He could say, I already told you that you protected him, and somehow, even though I see this bad stuff, somehow you took it easy on him. There could be no such claim if God gives his authority up to Satan, and Satan carries it out himself. All right? Also notice, we can't help but notice that God places limits on what Satan can do. Again, reminding us who's really in charge here. Okay? Now, this is the key point for this first conversation. This is the big point of this, and also one of the overarching points of the book of Job. Satan is trying to fault God on his creation. His creation that he just praised in front of Satan. Okay? If he can prove that someone whom God created and God declared to be upright is less than what he says, is less than what God says he is, then somehow God's made a mistake. If his own creation cares nothing for him and won't listen to him except out of greedy self-interest, well, someone should be an upright. I guess God must have made a mistake, right? Obviously not, that we know the end of the story. But again, If a man who's never seen God is able to maintain his integrity, even though he's never seen God, this is a huge slap in the face to Satan, who has seen God face to face. He's been in God's presence, and yet he sinned. Well, if a man can do it, that really makes Satan look bad, does it not? Okay. Then, of course, Satan goes out and does what he's been given permission to do, and I won't read over that because we're pretty much aware of what happens there. That's not the focus for this morning. The second conversation, that begins in chapter 2. And it says, I'll start reading in verse 2. Actually, in verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord." Okay. Now, if you notice, if you recall back in the first conversation, if we look back in verse 6 of chapter 1, it says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." Okay. You go to chapter 2, verse 1. "Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." To present himself before the Lord. It's different. It's a little bit different there. It's almost like Satan is proud of what has taken place, and now he has come to present himself before the Lord, having done what he has done. Here we go, God. We got something to present for you. All right? Now, he has different reasons for presenting himself before the Lord than the sons of God do. Okay? Now, this is a lesson for us. Despite Satan going to and fro and walking up and down on the earth, sons of God are back, presenting themselves before the Lord. And we know, because of what God himself told us about Job, that there is none like him on the earth. So we know that these sons of God are not as righteous as Job, but yet here they are striving for it anyway. It's just business as usual for them to present themselves before the Lord. They're continuing to strive for righteousness. Now, obviously, Satan has very different reasons than the sons of God do. And this is so interesting. Second conversation starts in verse 2. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.'" Identical question and an identical response. Okay? Now, if it was business as usual for the sons of God to present themselves before the Lord, guess what? This is business as usual for Satan. And the fact that his answer is identical as before, even though we have been given insight into what has happened, a part of what has happened, at least what's happened to Job, and Satan answers in an identical fashion as before, part of it almost sounds kind of smart aleckly, like, look at all the tragedy I just wreaked on this guy's life, and just been walking around on the earth, walking around to and fro, whatever. It's almost a little bit smart alecky in his response, but it should also convey the real character of Satan here. This is business as usual for him. And notice, he didn't just say, "I went down to Job's house, like you said, and I did what I did, and now I'm back." No, he still went to and fro on the earth, and he still went up and down on it. It wasn't enough for Satan to just tear Job's life in half and break it in pieces. He still went through the whole entire rest of the earth. Isn't that crazy? Like, it's not enough for him. Now, we know Satan's character. I won't necessarily turn to these verses right now, but Jesus describes Satan in John 8:44 as a liar. Revelation 12:9 describes him as a deceiver. Revelation 12:10, as well as Zechariah 3:1, says that he is an accuser. And come on, in Zechariah, he's accusing Joshua, one of the two people that from that generation that made it to the promised land. But nonetheless, there's Satan just waiting to accuse him. Okay. This should convey it's never enough for Satan. Never. All right. Now, this is an encouragement for us, and it's also a reminder. Despite all the havoc that Satan is able to wreak in people's lives, turn over to Romans 8. You can remember here the truth of the matter as it relates to us. Romans 8, starting in verse 38. It says, "For I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Despite whatever Satan is able to do, it's not going to stop us from being with God. That's our encouragement. It's followed by a reminder. Remember, Satan went down and tore Job's life apart. And then he proceeded to go through the rest of the world doing whatever he did. Now, this is a reminder for us. Nobody is so righteous that Satan will not go after us as well. He will not stop with the most righteous person on the earth. He'll go through all of us. All right? Now, God praises Job. This is a perfect response to the identical answer Satan just gave. In verse 3, Job chapter 2, verse 3, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason.'" Well, first of all, this proves Satan wrong from chapter 1, verse 11, when Satan said, "But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." Proven wrong, obviously. But despite this terrible tragedy that Satan was able to inflict on Job, God turns around in light of what Job's done after the fact and has just said, "Have you considered my servant Job?" So, in the same way that it's business as usual for the sons of God to present themselves before God, and it's business as usual for Satan to do what he does, Job's response to this all was business as usual for him. After all, he turns from evil, does he not? So then it must be business for us as well to strive for righteousness. Just like the sons of God, just like Job, that's what we have as an example. Now, of course, Satan has an answer for all this. Never runs out of things to say. Chapter 2, verse 4, "Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face.'" We've heard this before, all right? Of course, Satan doesn't admit he was wrong. He doesn't admit that he was just proven wrong. His big claim that he made earlier, proven wrong. But he does not admit that. Instead, what does he do? He changes his tactics. He doubles down. You know, basically, this reminds me of something, okay? If you'll indulge me a little bit here. If you remember from The Empire Strikes Back, this is from Star Wars, of the real Star Wars, not the new ones. Okay, the ones, the real Star Wars, all right? Toward the end, when things are falling apart and starting to unravel between Lando Calrissian and Darth Vader, and Lando realizes that he's not getting what he was promised, Darth Vader's phrase, I never forget it, and I can't imitate his voice well enough, so I won't even. But he says, "I'm altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further." That's kind of like this, like, I wasn't right before. Doesn't matter. I've got new rules. Let's play by those. I'll just make it up as I go along. Okay? Now, this is Satan's new tactic. Again, he has something that he knows will work. And he says, and now notice Satan's new idea. "But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh." Again, Satan is not being redundant here. This is when he says bone and flesh, this is not a generic reference to illness. Just think about it, okay? Bone and flesh. Flesh, we can see that. It's visible. It's obvious. If I had something really wrong with me on my skin, you could see it, right? Bones, underneath, below the surface. I can't see that, but you know what? If I had something wrong with my bones, it would be terrible. Right? Just think of some of the worst diseases that people can have are beneath the surface, and you can never see them. people might appear outwardly healthy, but if they have something like leukemia or something else, they could be getting torn apart inside, but you'd never even know it from the outside at a glance. But Satan's saying he wants both. He wants something. He wants God to touch Job's flesh and his bone. He wants something on the surface and beneath the surface. Okay? Now, once again, Satan admits that the power to do this is going to have to come from God. And once again, God does give him the permission to do this. In verse 6, chapter 2, verse 6, "And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." Okay? Now, another lesson for us that Job illustrates wonderfully is that we can maintain our integrity even if Satan harms us. Even when Satan harms us. Okay? Now there was a day. Now this is important to know. You see, first of all, after the second conversation when Satan leaves God's presence, this is how it's worded in verse 7, chapter 2, verse 7. "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head." Okay, now if we go back to Job 1, verse 6. "Now there was a day." Okay, that's the only part of that verse I'm going to read. If we go to verse 13, after that first conversation, it says again, "Now there was a day." So some time has passed between this first conversation and the tragedy that ensued because of what Satan did. We're talking about a different day. Now, some of these translations are going to, when it talks about each on his day, about the celebrations that Job's children would have, they'll say, I think the NIV says it, as a birthday. It's like a birthday celebration. Okay? Now, if you notice the difference, there's some time that elapses from the end of that first conversation until the tragedy that strikes Job. However, after the second conversation in verse 7, chapter 2, verse 7, "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job." This is within the same verse, within the same sentence. Boom. He leaves the presence of God and he strikes Job. Now we could say, well, it took some time to orchestrate all the calamity that struck Job after that first situation. After all, it was his eldest son. They were gathered in his eldest son's house. So, you know, maybe Job had to wait for his day to come along. And of course, he had to orchestrate this with the Sabaeans and all that, with the animals. Okay, whatever. Fair enough. There's a lot of players at work on that day, on that tragedy with Job. So it's logical in our human nature to try to think, how could this have been arranged just so perfectly in such a terrible way? Okay? And then we could say, well, all he had to do was strike Job himself this time with sores, and so that's why he did it right away. Again, fair enough, maybe. But in Job, like I said, in Job 1:4, this was on his eldest son on this particular day of after the first conversation. I sort of think that maybe Satan was irritated with Job, okay? And that's why he immediately struck him after leaving God's presence that second time. So maybe there was some time that had to elapse to get all the players in the game ready for that first tragedy. And maybe it was a lot easier for Satan to just go down immediately and strike Job after that second conversation. But don't you think Satan was probably really ready to go and do that after God just praised Job, who proved Satan wrong in that first conversation? Probably there was some vengeance involved there. Wait till you see this, Job. Well, now, I have to wonder, okay? I really have to wonder if Satan lacked, despite how crafty he is, if Satan lacked some insight into human nature. Okay? There's a phrase in the military, it's called, "There's no atheist in foxholes." You've probably heard this before, right? And it's talking about the hole that two people are in behind enemy lines to fight in. and to hide in if you need to. In a time when your life is in peril, that is a time when typically people think about God a little bit more. Even people that consider themselves atheists, strong atheists, will think about God if their life, if they perceive their life to be an inch from ending. So for Satan to claim that, look, if you take everything he has and then you strike his health, that this is what's going to cause him to turn away, I have to wonder if he lacked some insight into humanity, despite everything that he knows, despite having the advantage of watching multiple generations be born, live, and die. So it could be that, well, I mean, think about it. Think of the worst illness you've ever had, if you can remember that. I mean, I've had stuff that wasn't so terrible, but of course you always wonder, like, oh, what if I die? You know, what if this just escalates and never stops? What if I die? And I wasn't even seriously sick when I had that kind of a thought. I was already thinking along those lines, and I wasn't struck with these loathsome sores like Job was. So I got to wonder, did Satan just lack in a, did he just lack human knowledge a little bit? Or was it maybe that he just really wanted to inflict some harm on Job, the one guy that he just couldn't get to, that he just couldn't change despite his best efforts? I don't know. You know, if he can't get rid of him, then I can at least inflict some massive suffering on him. You know, and I'll do it with a smile on my face, considering God just praised him in front of me after I failed the first time, even though he didn't admit it. But we know this, okay? So who knows? These are the kind of things I wonder about now, and hopefully one day we'll understand a little bit better. Two important notes about these conversations. Number one, actually, let's read Job chapter 2, verse 9. Now, this is after both conversations are over. Job 2, verse 9, it says, "Then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die.' But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?' In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." Okay. So even though the conversations are over, Satan is still at work. With what Job's wife said to him, with what Job's friends will say to him, and the fact that Job's family has just deserted him as a result of all this, which he says in his speeches with his friends, so we know that his family has rejected him. God is still at work. God is still at work. Satan is still at work. Satan is still at work, despite having visited Job twice with terrible things, and here he is, trying to attack him through members of his family or his friends. Now, what is this really about? What are these conversations really about here? Okay. Again, the first thing is Satan is trying to fault God on his creation. He's trying to prove there's something wrong with the thing that God praised. That in fact, the man that God said is upright is not. Okay? That's what this is really about. Everything that ensues is a result of this Satan trying to fault God on his creation. Additionally, a man, just a simple human being, could maintain his integrity despite tragedy. That's our lesson and encouragement for us. And if it's business as usual for the sons of God to present themselves before the Lord, and if it's business as usual for Satan to go to and fro and to walk up and down on the earth, and if it was business as usual for Job to fear God and turn from evil, then it has to be business as usual for us to seek God's favor, to be upright, to turn from evil, despite anything that Satan can do to attack us. So that's another theme that I kind of see here, is it's business as usual for these players in this game, so to speak. And even though we weren't part of that, we're part of this. And it has to be business as usual for us to follow Job's example when he maintains his integrity. A big lesson here is we got to persevere to the end. Because in the same way that Job had to persevere, so do we. Job's story is over. We praise him for it. We honor him for his integrity and his example. But now it's us. Now it's down to us. Seeking to please God. Presenting ourselves before the Lord. Turning from evil. Now it's our turn. We got to do this to the very end. All right, so Basically, we don't want to do this halfway in this life. We want to persevere to the end. We want to be upright. We want to please God. It starts with being baptized into Jesus's. Well, we got to be baptized into Christ. We don't just pray our way into Christ. We don't just think our way into Christ. We don't just strongly believe and sincerely hope that we come into Christ. We're baptized into Christ. Romans 6, 3, and 4. So if you need to be baptized today, if this is the day, if that's you, then absolutely make your way forward here in a moment. But if you already have been baptized and you need the prayers for whatever reasons, you have issues, you have things that you need encouragement for, then we're all here and it's a perfect time for that. So if that's you, then please make your way forward as we stand and sing the song.